whether they really get the true picture and message of Islam and the liberty. But even if they did, it's not our function to hold them accountable for that. But that brings me to another sensitive term that I find many of even my Muslim brothers and sisters use it in a very generalized way, simply because of the lack of understanding of the origin of the term and what really it means. A lot of Muslims might use the term kafir and kuffar. You translate more or less like disbelievers, as if it is really, in a way, a derogatory term. Well, there is a difference between what is right and what is wrong theologically, but again, I keep emphasizing, theological correctness or incorrectness is left to God to judge all. But what exactly do we mean when we use the term kufr and kafir? Literally speaking, kufr means to conceal. To commit an act of kufr means to conceal. In a way, you can say that a farmer who is putting the seed and hiding the seed, concealing the seed in the ground, is doing an act of kufr. I'm not suggesting that you go to this farmer and say you're kafir, because you might get a blow in the nose. I mean, in the literal sense, it could be called he kafir. He hides, he conceals the seed in the ground. But then there is an interesting ayah that many Muslims do not really reflect carefully upon. Can a person be a Muslim and committing an act of kufr, not in the greater sense? Well, the answer comes in the Quran. When it speaks in that surah, surah 3, about pilgrimage, it says pilgrimage is mandatory on Muslims who are able to do that. And anybody memorize what does it say after that? وَمَنْ كَفَرَ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ غَنِيٌّ عَنِ الْعَالَمِينَ. But those who, if you take it literally, who commit kufr, Allah is self-sufficient. He doesn't need people. Here, kufr does not mean rejection of Islam or the Prophet, meaning being ungrateful. You're concealing your gratefulness to God for whatever He has given you. But, of course, in the theological sense, and that's why the Quran use the term kafir to people who deliberately rejected the truth, is that a kafir, in fact, is someone who is concealing or covering up his or her pure innate nature that knows that there is a creator of this universe. And that creator must be one to conceal the innate nature, the spiritual nature that the Quran expresses in breathing the divine breath in every human being, and to go against their pure nature to worship idols or not to follow the true faith of God. But then there's another aspect. And my brother Salim, when he was traveling, he asked me the same question. He said, I am confused and people keep asking me about that question. Can we really say that shirk, which literally in Arabic means to associate, i.e. to associate others with the one God in His divine, exclusive divine attributes, what is the difference between shirk and kufr and people of the book? I said, brother, the difficulty sometimes arises even in the mind of Muslims because these terms are used in a variety of meaning, layers of meaning depending on the specific context. I said, if you mean by shirk people who really worship gods beside God, then that description does not apply to the people of the book. And the evidence is found directly in Surah 98. لَمْ يَكُنِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ وَالْمُشْرِكِينَ. So it speaks about those who rejected even Islam in the ultimate sense, knowingly rejected Islam. But then it divides them into two groups. Those who associate others with Allah, like pagan Arabs, like those who believe in more than one God, as one category. But then the same ayah speaks about people of the book. People of the book. And they are quite distinct in that respect. And that's why in Islamic law, as you know, there are special affinity with them for both or all three Abrahamic religion, as normally they are referred to, believe in the one and same God. They could differ theologically how to understand God is the Islamic monotheistic formulation a correct one, or the Trinitarian formulation, or anything in between. They differ. But I have yet to see a Christian or Jew who say, I believe in more than one God, the same as upheld by a Muslim. They both believe in revelation of Allah, as Surah Al-Ankabut indicated, in moral teaching, in responsibility, in life hereafter. So there is some distinction also that is made there. But suppose even they deliberately rejected the Quran and said, let be no compulsion in religion. Another cut and paste. And this is one of the most curious ones. Somebody writes and says, the Quran uses derogatory terms against non-Muslims. And it says, non-believers are unclean. They refer to, again, to the same two surahs, actually to Surah 9, which deal with the state of war between Muslims and pagan Arabs. إِنَّمَا الْمُشْرِكُونَ najas. Again, you find a number of errors here. A number of errors. They take one part of one verse, number one. If you continue the verse, it says, they are not allowed to come to the sacred house after this year. Oh, sacred house, so there must be historical context. What is the historical context? Is that the pagan Arabs desecrated the Kaaba, the house of Abraham, the house of monotheism, by placing the idols in and around it. And as such, it would not be possible after Islam became the predominant religion in Arabia, or at least in Hijaz at the time, that people who worship Allah come to circumambulate around the Kaaba, and the pagan Arabs also bring the idols. It doesn't make any sense. Kaaba has to be restored to its pure monotheistic nature. But there is another form of uncleanliness, but not physical, that many of those pagan Arabs used to go around the Kaaba totally naked, which is indecent. So when the Quran used that term, then it uses in the context of, we might say, not really physical uncleanliness, that you have to wash yourself if somebody touch you. It talk about this. But more importantly is the mistranslation of the Quran, because the ayah says al-mushrikun, mushriks, and we have seen before the Quran made distinction between mushrik, like pagan Arabs who worship idols and multiple gods, versus people of the book. So the ayah does not have anything to do with Jews and Christians. It is related to that historical context and this particular situation in Arabia. Okay. Now, cut and paste number 6. Probably heard that. I think it should be 9-5. Kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. Ambush them. And wait for them in every corner. Probably heard that, right? The Quran teaches aggressiveness, and this is known as the verse of the sword. And it tells Muslims, go and kill the unbeliever, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. Of course, if you take it in that sense, from that one half verse, then every Muslim would be obligated to carry either a gun or sword or machine gun or whatever. Just go out, any non-Muslim you find, just the Quran tell you, God tell you that, you're doing that in the name of God. You know something, when I was studying in the early 60s, mid-60s at Indiana University, at the time there was a big debate in the United States about prayers in the school. And the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Douglas, I think his name at the time, you know, he made a statement. And he said, if we allow every person to do prayers in the school, in the beginning of the school, then the Muslims, misspelled of course, meaning Muslims, then the Muslims would recite the first verse in the Quran, the first chapter in the Quran that tells him to go and kill the unbeliever wherever he finds him. I think he got his number wrong, as well as his understanding also wrong.